This is the Mixed Coach Podcast, episode 53. In this episode, we've actually got an interview with Graham Cochran from The Recording Revolution with you, Kevin.
Yeah.
And he talked to you about a number of things. What did you guys talk about in the interview?
Oh, this interview actually was one of the first ones I did, too. Graham and I just got acquainted on the phone, and it was like one of those things where it's like, you know, why don't I just record the screen of us talking? And
yeah.
I think we talked for quite a while. We talked about, you know, some stuff that I had put out, like the hierarchy of mixing.
Yeah.
I think, and that was another, you know, we talked last week about the green shirt interviews. I think that was another green shirt interview.
Yeah.
Keeping stuff simple when you're mixing.
Yeah.
I
think mixing templates as well. You talked a lot about that as well.
Yeah, I'm a big advocate of using presets and templates. So we talked about that. Graham has really been complimentary and supportive of stuff we're doing here at Mix Coach. And so you should check out recordingrevolution.com. That's Graham's site. He's got a lot of, you know, 30 Days to a Better Mix. He's got a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah, there's
going
some really good stuff on there.
But Graham's a really cool guy. So check out this audio portion of the interview that we did with him. Hey, this is Kevin with MixCoach.com. Today, I've got Graham Cochran of TheRecordingRevolution.com. If you haven't seen his site, he's got a lot of really, really good information on there. He's got a free book that you can download that's got, what's it called, the number one thing?
The number one rule of home recording.
Yeah, well, it's got a lot more than one rule. It's got a rule for every aspect of home recording. I just read through it, and there's some really good stuff. And I think you and I are on the same page about less is more sort of thing. But, well, Graham and I have just cultivated a friendship via Skype and telephone calls. And I asked Graham, how can I help his readers to maybe get a different perspective on things? And what we came up with is that he would come up with a few questions that he gets from his readers all the time, and I would just answer them from my perspective. So that's what this show is about. So I guess, Graham, let's hear your first question.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on here. This is great because this is good for me. I'm always trying to learn, and then I know a lot of my readers have some questions about mixing. It always comes down to mixing because it's kind of the most complex aspect. So first question that I get all the time is, and I wanted to ask you on, is since you do a lot of mixing, and you've been doing this for a long time, and you know, you're award-winning mixing and that kind of stuff. People recognize your craft. How do you, as a professional mixer all the time, how do you approach a mix? You get a mix, and you know the style, the genre, and you're ready to sit down and work. How do you just approach it and tackle it? Workflow, what do you do first? What's your philosophy on mixing, that kind of stuff?
I found that when people send me a rough mix of a song that to listen to mix it, a lot of times they have the bones of the mix properly covered up, so you never know what you're getting into until you actually open the Pro Tools session. But usually the best thing to do, aside from listening to the rough mix that they send you via MP3 or whatever, is just to open up the session, you know, and get a feel for the song. I love to find out where the emotion of the song is, like where the song is trying to go. If it's loud guitars and loud drums and the vocals kind of almost screaming and stuff, you know that it's high energy and you want to add things to that mix that make it, you know, get there. If it's a mix that needs energy and it doesn't have it, then I'm always trying to, from a musical standpoint, trying to figure out how can I get it there. And it's not always brightening up the snare and making the kick bigger. Sometimes it's the opposite of that. I think sometimes you have to, from the very beginning, you have to figure out where the artist is trying to go in the song first, and then figure out how to get there. And then usually what I'll do is I'll start soloing things and see, before I start soloing things, I'll just kind of rough in a mix. And a lot of times when you get a Pro Tools session, they left the mix where it was. Unless they're doing it on a console and all the faders are at zero, a lot of times they'll have a mix dialed in. Usually I'll listen to that a couple times. And then
balance and panning and volume, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think, backtrack of what I do a lot of times, because a lot of times it's instinctual, because if that's even a word, because I approach mixing from a musician's kind of standpoint, because I'm a musician. You know, when somebody's playing a song and you just kind of walk over to the piano and you figure out what key it's in, I kind of do that from a mixing perspective. You know, that's where I'm trying to get my hand on the where the song is trying to go. But a lot of times I'll just listen to the mix. Sometimes I'll solo instruments. Like if I think the kick sounds funny or too clicky or not bright enough, I'll listen to it and see. In my mind, I'm soloing the kick to go, okay, if I brighten this up anymore, is a snare going to cut my head off? Because then you start figuring out how well it was recorded. And a lot of stuff that I get to mix, thankfully, is very well recorded. The stuff that's not, you know, I'm starting to make decisions then about if the kick is dull and it needs more snap to it, and you know that, okay, that's probably around 3 to 5K, and I'm going to have to crank that good, and then you solo the kick, and there's just as much snare as there is kick in there, then you start thinking, okay, how am I going to fix this kick? Because when I brighten it up, the snare is going to be crazy dominant. Anyway, so moving on from that, a lot of times what I'll do is, you know, listen and see if there's parts that are bothering me from the very beginning, like maybe a guitar part that's out of tune or something, or maybe a vocal that's out of tune. Because when I mix, I usually I'll listen from an aspect of what am I going to have to fix. You know, solo the kick drum, listen to the vocal. Oh, it's a little flat right there. So I'm kind of assessing the whole thing. Okay. And then basically, as far as workflow, I'm a big fan of templates. Not necessarily templates that you buy out of the box, but templates that you buy out of the box and go, wow, that really made that kick sound good, except it's a little too bright, or I don't like a gate on the kick, or something like that.
So, like a plug-in preset?
I use the SSL bundle for that Waves makes, and it's really good. And I have a preset that I have set up that's no EQ, the compressor set up the way I like it. I set up the compressor. I don't know if it's kind of an insider thing on the SSL compressor. And I show it on some of my videos, but instead of approaching it like set the ratio and then set the threshold, I set the threshold and then set the ratio.
Okay.
I don't know if you've ever done that before. Especially on the SSL, it just really sounds sweet, but I'm trying to remember. Okay, what we were talking about is presets. I have a preset that puts that SSL channel in the state that I like it. I like for the compression to happen after the filter, and because I don't like for it to be compressing something that happened in the real low end.
Right.
And then I think you may have mentioned some of this on your website. I don't like for the compressor to have to work on anything that's going to be filtered out anyway. So when you hit the split, it puts the filter before the compressor. I set that up, and then that's pretty much it, and that's called my startup preset. So I'll usually pull that up, and then I'll start yanking faders and stuff until I like it. I use Altiverb, and there's a reverb I like for slow songs, and there's a reverb I like for fast songs. And that's that's my go-to. That's that less is more thing. I could sit here all day. This is where I learned about this. I got a one rack unit called a Finalizer several years ago, and it was transformational on your mix, because you put your mix on, you think that sounds pretty good, and then you turn the Finalizer on, and it was like, oh man, that's huge. And this is where you make your mistake. Then you start going through presets, and you go, wow, ooh, yeah. And then 2 minutes later, you don't know what sounds good anymore.
Yeah.
This is why I use presets, because in my tutorial videos that I do, not the ones that are on YouTube, but the ones that are on my site and will soon be on my membership site, I talk about disconnecting the thinking side of your brain from the doing side of your brain. Left brain, right brain sort of thing. You don't want to be thinking like, let's see, the snare drum was on the third bank of eight. Oh, there it is. And I called it fluffy or something like that. You don't want to have to be thinking about anything like that when you're going more snare, boom. You know, it's like you want to set it up to where you can, everything is within reach. And I approach mixes that way, to where you pull up what you know works, And then if you want to experiment with it, you can. But, you know, you go to the area that works first. So anyway, I'm a big fan of templates, as I said, but also Pro Tools templates. I have a mix template that I set up, and I tweak it on every project, but usually I'll pull up that preset, and it's got all my buses, it's got all of my channels that I typically use, it's got all of my reverb returns, and I even have...
So let me explain that for my readers. So if let's say in Pro Tools is a good example, you open up your mix, then do you do like import session data as a template, or what do you do to then say, okay, I'm going to start with my mixing template? What does that look like if you've, let's say you've never mixed with a template before? Okay.
Well, I have a folder full of templates. In other words, every time I mix a project, if it's cut at the same studio, it's going to sound the same in certain ways. So I keep a folder full of those templates. They are just Pro Tools session files with no audio. So the first thing I'll do is I'll open up the session and I'll do a save as, because I always want a plan B. I always want an exit route, you know.
Absolutely.
So I always do a name of the song - Kevin Ward mix or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I feel free. It kind of takes the chains off. I don't have to worry about what if they really like that, blah, blah, blah. In the back of my mind, I'm going, I can always go grab it from the old session.
Yes.
The next thing I'll do is I'll create, before I close it, I'll create a folder called Old Session Files, and then I'll toss the old session files in there. So you've got an old session files that's like the tracking session, and then you might have the vocal session in there, and you then might have the background vocal session in there, and then you might have the ready to mix session where somebody got it ready for you.
Sure.
So you, but in the root part of the folder, you only see one thing. You don't have to go, let's see, when was this modified? Is this the latest mix? Because there's nothing more frustrating to somebody than to open an old session and go, it sounds just like I sent it to him. You know? But your question was about importing templates. So I'll open up the session, do a save as, and then I'll import session data. And sometimes what I'll do is I'll go back and erase all their automation. I'll listen to things that they have automated and just make sure that I can recreate it. And sometimes I won't erase it. Sometimes I'll just leave it there. But I don't automate anything that doesn't need to be automated.
Yeah.
Snare drum, kick drum, anything like that. If I can set it, set a compressor on it, leave it there, I do.
Yeah.
I just don't think that you need to ride every fader.
Right.
Anyway, what I'll do is I'll go through and I'll import all the things for this mix into the session, knowing that some of these you can either go over the track and replace the data that's in the template with the data that's in the Pro Tools session. You know what I'm talking about?
So you will start with this mix template and you'll bring in bring in the mix template on top of the session?
Yes. Sometimes I'll replace the old data, like their old plugins, and sometimes I'll just do it as a new track and drag the region to my track and then delete their track. It just depends. Sometimes I'll take their track and drag my plugins up to it. But I mix with a huge spider web of auxiliary inputs. I bus almost everything because there again, I'm getting back to the simplicity thing. It's a lot of work to set up the very first time, but importing a template, no big deal at all.
Yeah.
And then that way, if they want more drums, I just nudge a drum fader up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Instead of having to group everything, because then you're engaging another side of your brain that takes away from the creative side, to me anyway. But yeah, that I usually import. Sometimes I'll import everything as a new track, and drag thing, and you know, and then drag their regions to my tracks.
Got it.
So that's how I approach a mix. Have you ever noticed that the last thing that you mix is the loudest? You ever notice that?
Yeah, you're right.
Well, I noticed that probably about 10 years ago when I was mixing. This was before the days of Pro Tools, or affordable Pro Tools, I should say. I was mixing at the Sound Kitchen on their big Neve console, and the artist decided that at the last minute he wanted a harmonica overdub. So he got a harmonica player to come in, and the mix was done. sitting there, and then the harmonica did his thing, and I just tried to ride the harmonica in. Well, it was like every time I listened to it, I was going, that harmonica is just too loud. And what I figured out was that the last thing you mix is the loudest thing you mix. So I took out the vocal, I took out the background vocal, and I put the harmonica in the place in its plane. If you look at it like a pyramid, mm-hmm. all the tracks are at the bottom, and then the background vocals are in the middle, and then the lead vocals are at the top. If you take it back apart and you put the harmonica with the track, no problem at all riding it, right? So then you put, but if you wrote it on top of the background vocals, it would be louder than the background vocals.
Interesting.
So I started mixing is just a big mind trick to me. You know, if you can find a way to hack your brain to make you mix a certain way, then by all means, do it.
Yeah.
So anyway, when I approach a mix, I usually approach it from the bottom up.
That makes sense.
So drums first, bass, keyboards, guitars, all that kind of stuff, fills, background vocals, and then lead vocals.
That's that order. Yeah. Yeah. So then I guess two questions I'm thinking of right there. What do you do as you're building your mix to watch your overall level to make sure you're saving some headroom for that final vocal? You're not maxing out, you know? Well, do you do that intentionally, or is it usually leave room without even thinking about it?
Well, at this point, that's another good reason for templates. I mean, templates will tend to build that in. Mm-hmm. Usually I'll leave headroom, and a lot of times I'll mix with a mastering plugin. I know this flies in the face of a lot of traditional mixes and stuff, but I use Isotope Ozone mm-hmm. on the master fader, and I think that if you can EQ something one time, like if the whole mix is dull and you can do one EQ tweak and make the whole mix brighter, it's better than opening up a bunch of plugins on the kick, the snare, the toms, the hat, all the guitars, the vocals, and all that stuff, because then you get comb filtering. You get all these conflicting little nudges and pulls and stuff like that that make the mix sound, you can't put your finger on it, but it just doesn't sound right, you know? So, yeah, I'll leave room. Like, for instance, I'll look at I'll solo the drums, and I'll put the drums up there, and I'll make sure that the drums are, you know, not peeking out anything. Mm-hmm. They're kind of in the green, maybe touching the yellow every now and then on the mix fader. And then as I add stuff to it, I realize that, you know, that things are either good or not. And then I look at my compressors, and that's a good thing about templates too, is like when you get a template set up for a song and you know that you're just kind of kissing the limiter on the drums or whatever, and then you look at your limiter on the drums this time and it's like killing it, and you're mm-hmm. pulling it down 20 dB, then you might think, hey, I've got the drums too loud. There's not enough room to put the vocal in. So, yeah, so I guess the short answer to that question is, yes, I do watch levels during the mix to make sure I've got enough headroom at the end. And there, you know, as you mix longer, you tend to, that stuff becomes instinctual. And is instinctual a word?
I think it is.
I made it today. I'm putting it in Wikipedia right now. If it's not already, so does that help?
Friending is a word, so I think it's friending, like Facebook
really?
Friending.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Why not?
And Googling.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
So okay, and then my other question I was thinking about, just as finishing up your approach to mixing. When do you know you're done with a mix? I know other people have talked about this. I think it's a really good thing to talk about, especially guys that are mixing their own stuff and they're recording and producing their own stuff. They've been associated with this track for days, months, weeks, whatever. When do you know you're done with a mix so you can just move on and not make it worse? There's a point where you're starting to make things worse than they were.
That's a great question. I remember, and this is a throwback to when I first got started. I was mixing a project, and I asked my mom that. I didn't know who else to ask. I said, how do I know when I'm done? And she said, are they happy? And I said, they seem to be happy. She said, well, then you may be done. So since then, that's been quite a few years ago. Since then, in my mind, I have a checklist. when you know when you're done with a mix. Trying to think, I probably should have put together a little checklist to give you, but I think just off the cuff, I would say, if it's your own thing, that's another thing. And I don't know if you'll ever get, because you're so married to the stuff that you, I don't know if you ever know. I think there comes a point. I know I'm circling the land here, and I know it seems like I'm kind of like going around the subject. I'm trying to figure out the best way to answer this question. For me, when I'm out of time, when I'm out of money, that's when I'm done with it. There comes a point when you can do no more to the mix, and everything you do, like you said, decreases the end result. So when I set up my template, this is why I did it, I guess. When I set up my template and I had things going this way and I approach things, I have a method that I go about the mix. When I'm done with that little checklist, with that little method, I listen back to the mix. And then this is why I like for people to listen to the mix. When I get done with it and I like it, I go and listen to it in the car, might tweak it up a little bit, and then I have to say, I'm done with that for now. You know, this is beauty of Pro Tools. And then what happens when the client comes in and listens to the mix, you listen with a whole new set of ears. Have you noticed?
Yeah.
And then you'll find something like, that snare is a little too loud. And then while they're listening to it, you know, after they listen, you might make that little tweak. I think it comes with experience. I think we all tend to overdo it to begin with. What I have found is that mixes, when I worked in North Carolina, I did a mix one time that we mixed 30 songs in one day. 30 songs in one
day. That's not possible, man.
It is possible. And I was at home in time for supper. And the thing about it is, a couple of years ago, I listened to those mixes. And they were not bad. They were not bad. That's why I think it's something that you should try to avoid. You should try to work on your craft and get as good as you can. But when it comes time to actually mix, you should know when to stop. And you should stop occasionally and listen to it. Let it steep a little bit. Because if I can put it in musician's terms, have you ever had a guy that you knew could just kill it on guitar? And all you wanted him to do is put a little guitar solo on your song. Mm-hmm. And then when you put him behind the microphone, he freaks out and takes all day and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then the end result is not as good as you thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
And it's because the guy's mind got ahead of him.
Yeah.
He thought, you know, my whole self-worth is based on this guitar solo, and it's not. This mix you're doing right now, you need to make it as good as you can, but this mix does not define you. Mm-hmm. You gain experience from doing multiple mixes.
Or you have to finish something and move on.
You've got to deliver. I read a book called Lynchpins by Seth Godin. I don't know if you're familiar with him or not.
I've heard of him. I haven't read that one.
He's a great author, and he's one of the few guys that I get his blog in my inbox every morning. But one of the things he talks about doing is set a time limit, set a budget, and when you reach those, you are done. You've got to deliver the product. If you don't, then you're just living in fear of what I'm doing is not good enough.
Right.
You've got to be at some point brave enough to deliver your goods. If you're an artist, you're not an artist until the world can see your art. And, you know, people are going to criticize your mix. People are going to say, things like, did you trigger the drums? Or something like that, you know? And the thing about it is, you don't really start learning until people do say that. So I guess coming up from this very long, circly answer, the thing is, when you're out of time and you're out of money, set yourself a deadline first. Like you said, the false boundaries in your book, really good point. I said something like that in my book, although I can't remember exactly what I said, but there is strength in limitations. If you don't put limitations on anything, then you may never deliver your product.
Yeah.
Get it out there and move on. It's like songwriters. I work with songwriters a lot, and you can tell the difference between the professional songwriters and the amateur songwriters, because the amateur songwriters will sit on a song for years And they're still tweaking on it. But nobody's ever heard it. They've never demoed it. They've never sung it out. They're still working on it. And a professional songwriter knows that he has to deliver. Like he's got 3 hours or 6 hours to write this song. And at the end of the day, they need to have a song done.
Yeah.
So in settling, there's power and freedom. So anyway, I hope that helps with the when do you know you're done with a song.
I think so. On my side, I talk about recording myths a lot. Just stuff you hear on the internet. Now that we have the internet, everyone is privy to just talk like word vomit all day long online about gear and recording methods, and you need this to make a pro recording, and without this type of microphone, you can't make anything worth listening to. So that's always going on. But then I was thinking about mixing myths. Like, what is one of the biggest myths that you would say, now having a lot more experience than the average new mixer, that people would say is like, oh, this is how you need to mix, but really it's not true, and you found that it's maybe countercultural to do things a certain way? What's a big mixing myth that you would say is out there?
You know, I tend to want to say that you have to limit everything or normalize things. It seems like mixing these days and for the last several years, louder is always better. And I guess to a certain extent, that is true. Well, I think another, I think you touched on it too, is that you have to have a ton of plugins, and you have to have a perfect room, and you have to have a really expensive microphone. Excuse me, forgot to turn my ringer off on my phone. That you have to have a bunch of expensive stuff to be a good mixer. I think good mixing is being in touch with emotions, and being in touch with emotions of a song. I know that I mix differently depending on my mood. If I'm a little bit ticked off at somebody or something like that, I happen to be mixing a hard-hitting kind of hard country song or pop, rock and roll song with a lot of distorted guitars and stuff, I'll mix it like I'm mad.
Yeah.
So mixing is more about emotion and figuring out where the song needs to go to get the listener there emotionally, more than it is about having the latest plug-in. One of my mixing mentors, Kevin McManus, who's not doing a whole lot of mixing now, but he was the guy that inspired me to mix. He always told me, and I'm about to tell my age here, but he said a good engineer can make anything sound good. He said a Wahlensack. I never knew what a Wahlensack was, but a Wahlensack was like a junky old recorder back in the day.
Okay.
And it was like one of those portable interview type recorders that just sounded really bad. But he would always say to me, a good engineer can make a Wahlensack sound good. And what I took home from that was that you don't have to have a $10,000 microphone to make a vocal sound good. You just have to know that the mic they're using sounds good or it doesn't.
Right.
And you have to know whether this compressor sounds good on the snare drum or it doesn't, whether it's adding to the emotion of the song or it isn't. I think the myth is that you have to have all these plugins. And again, I think less sometimes is more.
So Kevin, I had one other question for you. I was thinking about with all of my new readers that are newer to mixing, a lot of them are, maybe they've been recording a long time, but they're trying to get better at mixing. Obviously the best way to get better at mixing is to do a lot of mixes, right? Finish projects, and just, it takes time. But if you could give like one tip or one simple tweak to a new mixer that they would almost see like instant improvement or noticeable improvement, that would almost be like a source of encouragement, like, sure, it's going to take time, but what's one thing you could tell a newer mixer that they could start doing today that would actually improve their mixes, and they would go, you know what, that helped, and I could keep doing this. What would you push that way?
That answer is so clear in my mind because I do it with just about every mix. The biggest tip that I can give any new mixer and any mixer period is that you have to compare your mixes to what's commercial and what you like. And you have to find out from your client if they're on the same page you are as to what sounds good. You might like a hard-hitting Chris Lord-Alge, Tom Lord-Alge, everything's compressed and right up in your face, And he may be thinking that Elliot Shiner is a better mixer, and or better for that style. And you go for the Chris Lord-Alge thing, and you get it sounding in your face and stuff, and they go, oh, I don't like that. I like Elliot Shiner's mixes better. So I would say, first of all, try to make sure that you're on the same page as your client is when it comes to mixing. Second thing is compare your mixes to what's commercial and what you like. Find that mix that you think sounds good, and every now and then pop over and listen. Is your snare drum that's the same, you know, does your mix sound like it could be the next song on that record? And because your ears change every day. Your ears are like, your ears are drums, basically. And have you ever checked out a drum on a very cold day? You know, it sounds different than a hot day or a humid day. And I believe, although I don't have any scientific data to back this up, I think your ears change every day. Have you ever, like, listened to a mix the next day and you go, what was I thinking? You know?
Sounds great at midnight. Exactly. Sounds horrible.
Exactly. Ear fatigue plays into it. But if you will introduce to your repertoire a mix that you know sounds good. It sounds good in your car. It sounds good in your truck. It sounds good on your stereo at home. It sounds good on your iPod headphones. Then you have that stake in the ground that says, this is what I know is good. It gives you a foundation. So if there's one thing I could give you is find that mix you want it to sound like and A-B it. I mean, your ears don't have a great memory. You know, have you ever listened to a song that you thought was great back in the late 90s? And then you listen to it now and you go, I really liked that. I thought that was a great mix back then. You know, so, I mean, because your ears don't have a memory, in my opinion. Again, no scientific data. But but you tend to forget what sounds good. And I read an interview with Chris Lord-Alge, and they asked him what he did before his mix every morning. He said he listened to Pyromania. One song off of Pyromania, which was a Mutt Lang production, and I don't know who mixed it, but it's just a great rock and roll mix, and that's where he lives. You know, he lives in that rock and roll thing. He says he listens to it while he's drinking his first cup of coffee, and then he goes to mix it. And that's his way of balancing. That's his way of setting the threshold for his mixing, I guess. So my number one point is to find something you know sounds good and use it a lot. You know, it could be a jazz thing. That if you're mixing a jazz thing, it could be a rock and roll. It could be a country thing. It could be a praise and worship thing. If you mix praise and worship and you like Hillsong United, then listen to a little bit of that before you get started, and even listen to it on the way. So, that to me is probably the most important thing you could do.
I agree. That's super helpful. That's awesome. Thanks a lot, man.
Good. Well, did you have any more questions, or that's pretty much?
I mean, that's great for right now. This is perfect. I think this is going to be really helpful to my readers and really getting a lot of people motivated and encouraged again to get back on it. Because I think, like you said earlier, we can wrap up our whole identity and this mix has to sound perfect and we want it to be good. We want to be improving, but it almost can be a source of discouragement that it's not good enough or I don't have the right tools. And I'm always trying to help people and motivate people to keep making music, because ultimately music is what we love. That's why we're in this business, whether you're doing it as a hobby or whether you're doing it for paid clients. So this is helpful because this really motivates me and all the people in the Recording Revolution, hopefully on Mix Coach, to just keep making music.
That was a really good interview.
Yeah, it was a little long, but yeah,
just a little bit. But there's a lot of great content in there. Like you said, the hierarchy of mixing, keeping it simple, and a lot of that stuff, like the templates and things like that, fast, you know, stuff that can really be helpful in the industry. We've kept on with these interviews, and I think it's been a really kind of a cool thing, you know, keep getting these interviews back out there and going back to the kind of the core principles that we started Mix Coach based on.
Yeah, people are, you know, really responding to these videos. I know that they're not accessible to everybody. They're really, the video part's only accessible to the members and stuff, but you know, and a lot of people were saying, you know, hey, we want these interviews so we can hear them in the car.
Yeah,
so we did that. So anyway, hope you liked this interview, even though this interview actually was done, I guess, you know, a couple
years ago now.
This stuff that I mentioned in the video is still applicable
to me. Yeah. I mean, I still save my templates. I still use templates.
You think of the hierarchy of mixing.
I still think of it. Yeah. I mix backwards and
yeah.
I don't know if I mentioned it exactly that way. I may have, I don't remember if I mentioned exactly, you know, mixing backwards or the hierarchy of mixing. But you know, you definitely have a pattern. I definitely have a pattern that I mix by, especially when I need to get something done. And I'm not trying to be a hero as far as like, I'm going to come up with my own reverb algorithm now to mix. You know, I definitely use presets. But anyway, hope you liked that interview with Graham. Graham's a cool guy. And check him out on TheRecordingRevolution.com. But first, come to MixCoach/member. All right. See you next week.